From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! An American nun raped and tortured in Guatemala demands President Clinton release all the information in her case and many others.
I hope that President Clinton will have the courage to listen to our cries for justice. We're not lunatics. We're not people who are creating stories. We're people who have lived torture. We are people who have seen our loved ones killed and are still waiting to find out what happened to them, because many people have disappeared.
And slavery in the Sudan, a debate between the Nation of Islam's top representative on Africa and a leader in the fight against chattel slavery. That and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today on the show, two foreign policy issues confronting the Clinton administration. We'll be talking about slavery in the Sudan, but first an issue that Clinton surely does not want on the front burner, the long-term relationship between the United States and Guatemala, a country whose military and paramilitary has killed more than 100,000 of its own people. In just a minute, we'll be speaking with Jennifer Harbury, the U.S. lawyer looking for the bones of her husband killed by the Guatemalan military. But first, we go to another woman. I'm going to read from yesterday's Washington Post, a column by Mary McGrory. She writes, Sister Diane Ortiz stood under the budding tulip trees of Lafayette Square and implored the man across the street to feel her pain. Sister Diana doesn't look much older than President Clinton's 16-year-old daughter, Chelsea, but she's a 37-year-old Ursuline nun who survived a hideous chapter in Guatemala's grim story. In 1989, she was kidnapped, raped, and tortured by Guatemalan death squads and turned loose with more than 100 cigarette burns on her body, and a story nobody wanted to believe. This week, Sister Diana is holding a vigil outside the White House demanding President Clinton release all relevant information in her case and many others. She's demanding that the U.S. government come clean in its relationship with the death squads of Guatemala. Sister Diana's vigil is silent. She's only speaking for 2 hours a day between 10 in the morning and noon. She wouldn't break this personal vow to come on Democracy Now!, but Pacifica's Julie Drizin went to Lafayette Park yesterday morning to talk to her.
The reason I'm sitting in front of the White House is because I'm holding a silent vigil, a vigil for truth. In 1989, I was abducted and tortured by Guatemalan security forces, and at one point there was a North American or a U.S. citizen who was present, and he was able to give orders to the Guatemalan security forces. He was referred to as Alejandro, and he had the authority to give them orders. He had access to a clandestine prison where I and other Guatemalans were tortured. And for more than 6 years, I've been trying to find out why I was targeted and trying to find out why the people of Guatemala are still being persecuted. And Alejandro, I believe, is the key. And for many years, the identity of Alejandro has been protected by the U.S. government.
What were you doing in Guatemala at the time?
I was teaching young children how to read and write in their Mayan language. And I don't believe that's any subversive type activity. Any person who opts to walk and to live with the poor is a threat to the military inside Guatemala.
I know that you have told the story of what happened to you many times, and it's an extremely painful story to tell and a painful story for people to hear, but I think it's important for people to hear what exactly happened to you.
I'll try to be as brief as possible. After I was abducted, I was taken to a clandestine prison inside Guatemala City, and I was interrogated, and I was burnt with cigarettes more than 111 times on my back and my chest. And I was gang raped, and I was lowered into an open pit that was saturated with human bodies. Sometimes I dream of just forgetting what happened, and I can't because I remember not only what I experienced, but I remember what I witnessed. I saw other people being tortured, and that is a memory that stays with me. It's embedded in the depths of my soul, and for some reason I survived the nightmare of November 2nd. I don't know why, but I know that I have an obligation to speak the truth and to prevent the torture of another person.
You're outside the White House. I'm wondering, have you been on the inside? Have you had a chance to speak to members of the Clinton administration about what happened to you?
I have met with the Intelligence Oversight Board, and they are aware that I'm holding a vigil in front of the White House. And also, I've met with Nancy Soderbergh, and she also, and the people that she works under, the Clinton administration, are aware of the vigil as well. They have expressed sympathy. They have expressed frustration for the mere fact that it's taken me this long to find out the truth. But at the same time, the report is not going to be released until maybe a month or a month later. So,
what demands are you making with this vigil, demands of the Clinton administration at this time?
I'm asking President Clinton to declassify information pertaining to my case and also pertaining to all Guatemala human rights abuses from 1954 to the present. I'm also asking President Clinton to release the full text of the Intelligence Oversight Board report.
How do you know for sure that the person who was involved in your torture was an American citizen or doing the work of the American government?
Alejandro spoke in poor, broken Spanish, and it was heavily accented. And at one point during the torture, or at one point after he escorted me out of the clandestine prison and into the Jeep, he spoke to me in perfect English. And he also does not have characteristics of a Ladino or a Mayan. He was a U.S. citizen. I have said that from day one, and I still say that today.
You've survived something that most Americans can barely allow themselves to begin to imagine. What is it that keeps you going, that allows you to continue in spite of the terror and torture that you've been through?
I know what it's like to be tortured, and I know what it's like to be a witness of the torture of other human beings. And I will do whatever I can to prevent that from happening, even if it means I have to sit in front of the White House to get the truth. Because if our government is aware that American citizens know that people inside Guatemala or inside Honduras or Salvador or other countries, that they're present at torture sessions, they are, our country is an accomplice of torture. I hope that President Clinton will have the courage to listen to our cries for justice. We're not lunatics. We're not people who are creating stories. We're people who have lived torture. We are people who have seen our loved ones killed and are still waiting to find out what happened to them, because many people have disappeared. There are mothers and fathers who have no idea where their children are.
Sister Diana Ortiz, how long are you planning to maintain this vigil outside the White House?
It's indefinite. Perhaps it's best to answer your question with a question. How long will the U.S. government keep the truth from me?
Sister Diana Ortiz speaking to Pacifica's Julie Drizin yesterday in Lafayette Park across from the White House. One of the people who's been standing with her at different times is Jennifer Harbury. Jennifer is a human rights activist and Harvard-trained attorney whose husband was the last Mayan Guatemalan rebel leader. His name was Efraín Bámaco Velásquez. He was captured and killed by the Guatemalan military. Jennifer has been on a mission to find out what happened to him for years and discover that the man allegedly responsible for Bámaco's death, Colonel Julio Alpírez, was on the CIA payroll. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jennifer Harbury. Jennifer, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Jennifer, you and Diana Ortiz and a number of other of North Americans are part of Coalition Missing, which is a group of North Americans whose family members were killed in Guatemala or who themselves were hurt in Guatemala. Before we talk about exactly what your group is demanding of President Clinton, I wanted to ask you about your own story and about the story of your husband.
Yes, yes. As you know, my husband's real name was Efraín Bámaco Velásquez. He was a Mayan peasant in Guatemala who joined the URNG forces very, very early on in the war. He spent 17 years in combat and very quickly rose to be a comandante of the ORPA section of the URNG. In fact, I believe he was one of their youngest comandantes for many years. His first wife was killed in an ambush next to him. His second wife was tortured to death by the Guatemalan army. He himself vanished into thin air in the middle of a combat on March the 12th, 1992. The army said that he had been killed in that combat and that they had buried him in Retaluleo, a nearby town. And they sent a perfect feature-by-feature description of him saying that's the body that they had found and buried. Later, an eyewitness escaped from a military base and said that it was all a hoax, that he was in fact inside being tortured. And this person had in fact seen him a number of times and said the man bending over the torture table during a particularly severe session was Colonel Julio Roberto Alpírez. Upon hearing this, I returned to Guatemala in 1993, opened the Retaluleo grave, and found that, in fact, it was not my husband. It was a completely different person. And that launched my series of hunger strikes, which, as most of you know, culminated in the announcements last spring by Congressman Torricelli that my husband had been killed after he was captured alive by the army. He'd been tortured for a very long time by the army and had, in fact, been killed without a trial in 1992. The man who apparently gave the orders for that extrajudicial execution was Colonel Julio Roberto Alpírez. Alpírez is also a CIA asset, a man paid by the CIA to give information to them. And in the course of the ensuing months, I had to file not only a FOIA request against all the different U.S. government agencies, but I also filed a lawsuit against the CIA to force compliance. And out of all of the files that I've received, I've pieced together the following story. Colonel Julio Roberto Alpírez is not only a CIA asset, he's also a graduate of the School of the Americas. My husband was taken alive during that combat. A different soldier was shot and battered to pieces, literally, and placed at the combat site as part of a hoax. That's the person who lies in the graveyard in Retaluleo. Meanwhile, my husband was subjected to long-term torture and various psychological abuses in the hopes of extracting all the information that he had as a commander who'd been in the mountains for 17 years. In July of 1992, the CIA paid Colonel Julio Roberto Alpírez $44,000. They knew at that point that my husband was a prisoner. In fact, they knew he was a prisoner 6 days after he was picked up. I have a document from the CIA notifying the White House and the State Department that Comandante Everardo had been captured and that the Army would fake his death to better take advantage of his situation as a secret prisoner of war. They then, as I said, turned around and paid Alpírez $44,000 in July of 1992. That's exactly the month that the eyewitness saw Alpírez bending over the torture table, and it's Alpírez who apparently, reportedly, eventually had my husband killed without a trial. So we have very clear evidence of the CIA working very closely with the Guatemalan army and the Guatemalan death squads. They know who's who. They know where prisoners are. They know immediately when prisoners are taken. They know where a number of clandestine cemeteries are. In various of the documents that I've received, there will be titles like clandestine military prisons, and then the entire section is blanked out. Or there'll be a section on clandestine graveyards. They refer to a well where a number of prisoners were thrown after they were killed, including, quote, certain friends of Bámaco's, unquote. So there's a, a very clear situation here that I think all of us in coalition nursing want to get to the bottom of. I'd like to add that since I filed my civil rights case against the CIA, two Guatemalans have come forward to talk to me privately. One of them is a torture survivor like Diana Ortiz, and told me that while he was lying on the floor bleeding, a large, you know, tall, blondish gringo, heavily accented Spanish-American accent, walked in and talked to his torturers and then walked back out, did nothing to save him. Just as in my own case, the CIA informed the White House and the State Department that my husband was a secret prisoner of war, knowing that he would be tortured to death eventually, and did not notify the Red Cross and did not notify the UN. They could easily have saved his life back then with a small anonymous note. The second person who spoke to me recently is in fact a member of the security forces and said that he was present at various sessions when electrical shocks and other methods that he would not describe were used on certain prisoners, and that it was not unusual for tall, blondish North Americans to come in and out of the room.
Jennifer, one of the ways that you've gotten the amount of information you have is by staging your own vigils, as Sister Diana Ortiz is doing this week outside the White House, and who knows how long that will go on. You were on a hunger fast in Guatemala. You've also staged those fasts on the steps of the Capitol. Why is it so hard to get this information? In fact, it seems that you wouldn't have gotten the information from New Jersey Congressmember Robert Torricelli if you hadn't engaged in this series of fasts, which were very much threatening your life.
That's right. I was on a hunger strike in Guatemala for 32 days. I think Bobby Sands, who was in fact the inspiration for that hunger strike, survived for 44 days. I'm 5'3". I wouldn't have survived for a whole lot longer. Things only began to move when 60 Minutes basically blew the whistle on the U.S. Embassy saying, by the way, they do so have a CIA bulletin, and it does say he was captured alive. Until then, the embassy had been saying, well, we've asked and asked what happened to your husband, and the army says they don't have him, so what more can we do? It was only when the 60 Minutes bulletin came out and it became clear that I had perhaps a week or 10 days left before I suffered kidney failure or possibly went into a coma or had other very, very serious physical problems. It was only then that the first half of the truth came out, and then only half of it came out. It was in the spring when I returned to my hunger strike out of frustration at being stymied once again and had gone 12 days without eating. My upper lip was already starting to freeze over. I was far too weak to take on another hunger strike. It was only at that point that Congressman Torricelli very bravely came forward and, in fact, took a lot of abuse for telling me the truth. And, in fact, by telling me the truth, he saved my life. And here we have Diana Ortiz, who's been basically re-tortured by our own U.S. government all these years. I've listened appalled for years and years and years as she's tried to tell her story. She's been desperate to get the truth out because she worried and agonized about all of the Guatemalans in that house who were not rescued with her, who were left to bleed to death in that pit. That idea has haunted her for all of these years. And instead of sending someone back to rescue those other people, instead of having Diana Ortiz on the air and giving her full credibility and hurrying to try to put an end to these human rights abuses, I've heard her spoken to with an outrageous level of disrespect directly by U.S. officials. I've heard her spoken about behind her back by different U.S. officials in a tone of voice that I can only describe as absurd. Poor little sister Diana Ortiz, she's so traumatized, maybe she got mixed up and doesn't really know what happened to her. Well, Diana Ortiz knows exactly what happened to her. The problem is, in my opinion, that the U.S. government cannot stand the light of day for its own relationship with the death squads in Guatemala. And if it can't stand the light of day, maybe something needs to change. That's why we're demanding the files. We want to get the whole truth, and I mean the whole truth, about exactly what that relationship is. What are our tax dollars doing paying the salaries of foreign torturers and death squad members? Don't we have any schools we need to build? Don't we have any sick or elderly people we need to take care of? Don't we need to balance our budget in this country? Do we really need to pay people like Colonel Julio Roberto Alpirez? Do we really need to be paying people who would rape a nun and place her in a pit with dead bodies with 111 cigarette burns on her back? Do we really need to be spending this money on this particular matter? We have a right to know what's being done in our names as taxpayers, as voters. We have a right to take our government back. We have a right to insist that a secret branch of our government cannot be allowed to exist. That cuts against the most basic principles of our government in this country. It cuts against the most basic principles of our Constitution.
Jennifer,
so we need the truth.
Jennifer, yeah. We're going to be back in 1 minute. Jennifer Harbury, okay. Human rights activist and attorney, whose husband, Guatemalan Mayan rebel leader Efraín Bámaco Velásquez, was captured and killed by the Guatemalan military, killed by a man who was on the payroll of the Central Intelligence Agency. We'll be back to talk about her, to talk about whether there's a difference with changes of administration. And later in the show, we'll be having a debate on slavery in the Sudan. You're listening to Democracy Now. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily national grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. And joining me in the studio in Washington is Jennifer Harbury, human rights activist and attorney whose husband was killed by the Guatemalan military. He was a Guatemalan Mayan guerrilla comandante known as Everardo. And she has been in pursuit of the truth for a number of years now. In fact, I think it's safe to say she has been the one to focus attention on the crimes in Guatemala in a way that many people who've been working on this issue for decades since the CIA overthrew the Guatemalan democratically elected president in 1954. Even though people have been working on that issue, this is the first time it's gotten the kind of attention it has. Let me ask you something, Jennifer. A couple years ago, I was covering the Harvard Kennedy School of Government's graduation when the former defense minister of Guatemala, Hector Gramajo, graduated from there. Just before he received his diploma from Harvard, he was slapped with a lawsuit by 9 Guatemalans who are living in the United States and Canada for crimes against humanity against their families. A week later, he was sued by Sister Diana Ortiz herself, who today, as we speak, is in the midst of her silent vigil in front of the White House, demanding that the U.S. release all the information in her case and many others. Now, since that time, he has been found guilty in a civil court of the crimes he was charged with. But even since that time, he has been called back to the School of the Americas in Georgia to address the graduating officers there. You mentioned the School of the Americas when talking about the man you believe killed your husband. Can you explain it and what's going on in Congress around it?
Yes. For a number of years now, Father Roy Bourgeois has been leading a movement to have the School of the Americas closed on the grounds that it turns out a terrifying number of the worst human rights violators anywhere in the world. And that's certainly true. There are other military schools that train people from around the world. Every now and then they turn out someone that turns out to be a bad apple, let us say, who does commit, you know, war atrocities. The School of the Americas turns out an appalling number of those particular types of people. If you read through their list of graduates, it's like, you know, reading through the 10 most wanted list or the 1,000 most wanted list, let us say, of war criminals anywhere. 2 people involved in my husband's torture and assassination that were seen by the eyewitness are School of the Americas graduates. That's just one recent example. Congress does have a bill to, carry out serious reforms and hopefully to close down the School of the Americas going on at this time, as I said, led by Father Roy Bourgeois, and I've supported that movement for a number of years. The claim by the government that it's just a coincidence that these people have all been graduates of the School of the Americas, these really unbelievable human rights violators, it just doesn't make any sense. It's against the laws of physics. It can't be coincidence that all of the worst ones come from that one place and that other similar military schools don't turn out anywhere near that number of torturers and assassins.
What is President Clinton's stance on the School of the Americas?
I'm not sure. I don't think he's taken a very strong stance one way or the other so far, and I wish that he would.
Well, right now we're in an election year, which means that regular citizens like you, like Sister Diane Ortiz and others, actually have a bit more access to the highest officials in our land, like President Clinton. After all, he does have to go out on the campaign trail, although granted, access is pretty controlled. Do you have plans in this election year to try to reach President Clinton? Have you talked to him directly?
I've never been able to speak with President Clinton directly. I would like very much to. I met him at a reception once for about 2 seconds to shake hands, but I'd like very much to speak with him. I know that all of the people in Coalition Missing, as well as certain other people in an Amnesty International network, would like very much to speak with him about their family members that have been killed, where there have been clear involvement of U.S. government officials. You know, certainly evidence that people like Alejandro and Diana Ortiz's case were present or involved. We would like very much to talk to the president. We have not chosen this moment because it's an election year. We've chosen this moment because almost an entire year has gone by since Congressman Torricelli's information. The Intelligence Oversight Board was supposed to come out with a report a very long time ago. Most of the people in Coalition Missing have received nothing to date. The intelligence report is not out yet, and people like Diana Ortiz have been waiting since 1989, many people even longer, to find out the truth about what happened to their family members and why.
Jennifer Harbury,
I think time's up.
Yesterday, I talked to the State Department, asked them to come on. I also called the White House. They didn't respond. Well, the State Department wouldn't have a representative on the show. They did fax me the State Department briefing of Monday when Glenn Davies, the acting spokesperson for the State Department, responded to a question saying the IOB, that's the Intelligence Oversight Board, will present its results to the president in the next 3 months or so. At that stage, all appropriate information will be made available to both Sister Diane Ortiz and to the public. How much information has been made available in your case, and how much hope do you hold out for Sister Diane Ortiz to get information in hers?
Sister Diana Ortiz must receive her information. She has been basically retortured by the U.S. government officials now for 7 years, ever since she was able to escape from the pit in Guatemala. She must know what happened. She must know why. She must know what became of the others, or she will never, never heal. It is critical that she receive her information. To date, she has received nothing. I've received information because I went on 3 hunger strikes total. I then filed all my FOIA requests, did not receive that information at any kind of reasonable timetable, and was forced then to sue the CIA to get anything from them at all. I now have some information. I do not have all of the information. That's a real problem for me for proceeding through the courts in Guatemala against people like Alpidas to put them in prison. It's very damaging to my access to the courts, in other words. It also makes it very difficult for me to obtain my husband's body back. I have one report that he's buried at the Las Cabañas military base, but with other Guatemalans, specifically with between 500 and 2,000 other Guatemalans who were killed by the army there. There are other reports that he's buried somewhere else, and I'm not given access to the information that would hopefully help me evaluate those different reports and figure out where he is buried and obtain his body. It's going to be quite a battle. I intend to get the information and get to the bottom of this, and I intend for all of the Guatemalans who had suffered, as Diana Ortiz has suffered. We're talking about 200,000 people, maybe many more. Most of them are dead now. Their family members are left behind, but they have not forgotten, and they have not healed. We, all of us in Coalition Missing, intend for the Guatemalans to get their information so that they can turn the corner, they can put the death squads in jail, and they can protect the next generation. If the army gets away with 200,000 killings and nothing happens to them at all, then they're going to kill another 200,000 people, and that's not fair to our neighbors.
Jennifer, do you think it matters if there's a Republican or a Democratic administration in the White House when it comes to Guatemala?
I would like to think that it matters. I would like very much to think that it matters. And I certainly invite President Clinton to turn the corner and release these files as a step towards reform of our own government, as a step towards cleaning house. I invite him with all my heart to please turn that corner and start cleaning up with us.
Wouldn't that mean turning in the people who work for him as well in the U.S. government?
If people in the U.S. government have contributed in any way to the torture, secret imprisonment, and murder of another human being if they are covering up for the torture, secret imprisonment, and murder of other human beings, then they must come forward. They cannot be shielded.
Jennifer Harbury, we do have to wrap up. If people are listening now who want to support Sister Diane Ortiz, support you in your pursuit of finding your husband's bones, how can they help? Is there a number they can call?
I recommend that they call the White House comments line and voice their opinion to President Clinton that all the CIA files on human rights cases in Guatemala, all the human rights files, be declassified, made available to the public. Let us know what our government has done. We must know.
Jennifer Harbury, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Again, Jennifer Harbury, a U.S. attorney, human rights activist, pursuing the case of her own husband and what has happened to him, Guatemalan rebel leader Efraín Bámaco Velásquez, and also the case of more than 100,000 Guatemalans. Sister Diane Ortiz, as we speak, is standing in silent vigil outside the White House. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Coming up next, a debate on slavery in the Sudan. But first, these few notes to let people know what has happened in the last 24 hours. Two professors from the City University of New York School of Law were killed yesterday in a highway accident in Cape Town, South Africa, where they were attending a conference on democracy and international law. The university identified the victims as W. Haywood Burns, the law school's dean from 1987 to 1994, and Margaret Shannara Gilbert, an associate professor at CUNY Law School. They died after a truck ran a stoplight and hit a car in which they were passengers. This morning on WBAI, Pacifica's radio station in New York, we took calls for several hours talking about these two great civil rights activists and lawyers who have paved the way around civil rights law in this country. And following up on another story that we did last week on Democracy Now! Around the firebombings of churches in the South, today the cover story of USA Today, two of 31 federal agents who may face disciplinary action for attending a gathering where racist acts occurred are also investigating arsons at Southern Black churches. The two Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms agents are among 12 federal law officers who saw racist activities at what the Treasury Department calls good old boy roundups between 1989 and 1995. The agents did nothing and attended more roundups. ATF and Justice Department officials will decide if the two agents will be taken off the investigation of 18 arsons at Black churches in the South. There have been at least 21 such fires since January 13, 1995. We'll be discussing the Sudan next on Democracy Now! Stay with us. And you're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's national daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman, and joining me in the studios in Chicago is Salim Muakil, my co-host and editor, senior editor at In These Times, and a columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times. Salim, are you there?
I'm here, Amy. Good morning. How are you doing?
It's good to hear you. Well, in recent years, reports from Sudan and Mauritania reveal that a human slave trade persists there. The abolitionist movement in the West is infuriated at the Nation of Islam minister Louis Farrakhan, who visited the Sudan, but denies that slavery exists there. And today we're going to have a debate on this subject. Salim.
Yes. Amy, we have with us today Mr. Nate Clay, who's part of this new abolitionist movement. He's part of something called the International Coalition Against Chattel Slavery. And for several years, actually, Nate has been trying to attract interest in this issue and publicize this issue around the country at different forums. And recently he had a forum in Chicago which was packed with people interested in this issue of slavery in Mauritania and the Sudan. But also at the forum that there was an indication that a rift may be forming within the African-American community between those who profess Islam, those who adhere to Islamic principles and those who have questions about the effect of Islam on blacks on the continent of Africa and in the diaspora. Mr. Clay has been very prominent in this, in trying to attract attention to this issue. And I just wanted to ask you, Nate, what got you interested in this issue of slavery, and why do you think it's been so downplayed among black activists?
Well, let me say this. I don't know if it's been systematically downplayed among black activists. Most just didn't know. I learned about this issue during a tour of Africa back in 85, I believe it was. I was invited, along with several other journalists. I was the only black journalist in the crowd, this group of white journalists, and we were invited by Egyptian Airlines and to tour the areas of Africa where they do business. And so we ended up going to Egypt and then on to Kenya. And I recall very vividly, let me back up a little bit. It's a common practice when you're traveling in a group as journalists, the hotels you stay in as a courtesy will, when you wake up in the morning, they have several newspapers, international editions of well-known newspapers outside your door. And I woke up this particular morning, it was around this time of the year, around 85, I believe it was, and there was a copy of the international edition of the Wall Street Journal stuck under my door. And I was I picked up the paper, intending to throw it down and read it later, but then my eyes fell on this front page story headline, and I still have this article, by the way. The headline of the story was, Resurgence of Slavery in the Sudan. Well, of course, I sat down immediately and consumed, I think is the best word for it, this article. And then I kind of pushed it in after that. I talked it over with my fellow reporters. We were traveling. They knew nothing about it, of course. And I kind of pushed it to the back of my mind. Then a year or so later, I was in Libya with Minister Farrakhan, by the way, the year that the Americans first bombed and strafed the Gulf of Sidra. And traveling with my late friend, Wally Muhammad, who was the editor of Final Call. And we were in Tripoli, and one day Gaddafi decided to give us an outing, and we went and spent the day with Bedouin up in the hilly mountainous area of the country. It was a cold, kind of windy, rainy day, misty day, I should say. And we got up, after a long, long ride over rugged roads, we got up into this remote area, and as we arrived, the tribesmen came to greet us, and the food was all laid out. It was a big festive atmosphere. And I was preparing to experience my first camel ride, trying to get up on this camel. And I looked over at the corner of my eye, and I saw this black man, unmistakably Negroid. And thought immediately to myself, it's strange. How is this one lone black man in this remote area out here with these Arab tribesmen? And I talked to one of the Bedouin. Now, mind you, the Bedouin are considered the least sophisticated. They're not a people given to duplicity because they don't know that certain things are verboten. And they had no idea that they should not talk about this kind of issue. And so when I asked him, just out of my own naivete, who is he? I pointed to this black man, and the tribesman said, he turned, looked where I was pointing. He said, oh, him? He said, brother slave. And I said, what you say? He said, brother slave. Well, even then, I didn't think he actually meant somebody owned by somebody else.
But you found out later that was the case.
Later on, when I got back to the U.S., And I call up the UN. I'm a journalist. I publish a newspaper. And I get a lot of stuff from the UN. I start getting these documents. Come to find out that this was a little kept secret that many people in certain circles already knew about.
Yes. Nate Clay, I want to interrupt because we have to break for a minute. You're listening to Nate Clay, who is chair of the International Coalition Against Chattel Slavery and publisher-editor of the New Metro News of Chicago, also Salim Wakil in Chicago. When we come back, they'll be joined by Akbar Muhammad, Africa representative of the Nation of Islam, and Louis Farrakhan. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's national daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Joining me in Chicago, Salim Wakil, senior editor in These Times, as well as Nathaniel Clay, chair of the International Coalition Against Chattel Slavery. And joining us on the telephone, Akbar Muhammad, Africa representative of the Nation of Islam, and Louis Farrakhan. Mr. Muhammad, you just heard what Nate Clay had to say. Have you found this in your own travels in Africa?
First of all, good morning, and thank you very much for having me on the show. Nate Clay, as a matter of fact, the trip he went to Libya, I was the one who set his trip up for those journalists that went to Libya during that conference. This is the first time that I heard this totally ridiculous story, and I'm surprised at a man of such intellect saying such a thing about Libya that has a tremendous black population. And anyone who has read the history of Libya knows that Gaddafi in 68 and 69, before his revolution, started in a southern town called Saba. And in this town, 70% of the Libyans are black Libyans. The ambassador to the UN before the last ambassador, who is here now, is a man named Ali Hadari, who is a black Libyan. The ambassador in Libya to the Sudan is a black Libyan. The ambassador to Cyprus for many years, a man that was very close to Billy Carter, President Carter's late brother, was a black Libyan named Shahati. Libya has a tremendous black population, a country of 3.5 million people. And for Nate Clay to come on the radio to an audience that is not as knowledgeable of Libya and Libyan politics and accuse the Libyan of slavery is outrageous. And to me, it seems that Nate evidently is working on behalf of those same people who would like to deny Minister Farrakhan the money that Brother Gaddafi promised him. And because the American government has a problem with Libya, it just is very painful to see members of the black community pick up and champion the cause of America and accusing Libya of slavery. Brother Muammar Gaddafi, Nate Clay, we listened to you carefully. We did not interrupt. We did not say a word. We're not on the radio to argue. I don't think it's that kind of format. You stated your case. Let me state mine.
Go ahead.
Muammar Gaddafi's Green Book, he has a section on the black man. He deals with minorities, women, and black people. And Brother Muammar Gaddafi, someone that I have known personally since 1983, if he could hear such an outrageous conversation, of course there's black Libyans,
but these are not
Libyans that are trucked across the border from the Sudan and sold into slavery.
We're talking about the Sudan and Mauritania.
He hasn't been to the Sudan that I know of. I've been to the Sudan 11 times starting in 1977, and I'll talk about the Sudan, but he immediately talked about Libya. If we want to talk about it.
I didn't finish. I did not finish what I was talking about in the first place. I was asked, how did I first become aware of this issue? And I was given a truthful account of
okay,
what
well,
happened.
I'm
and if
I'm responding
wait a minute, wait a minute. Now,
I didn't finish.
You were
I'm
not,
on the radio
gentlemen.
Show, can, I'm on the radio
gentlemen, can
show,
we? Can we keep?
Okay,
thoughts,
I stand
can
by.
Can we keep?
Look, I stand by every word I said, and in fact, I took it under my own authority to talk and stop black Libyans on the street of Tripoli after that incident. And Wally was with me, and if he were alive, he could verify this. We went out of our way to talk with black Libyans after that incident. And in fact, downtown Tripoli, most would not talk. But we did, in fact, get a few. Most would give you the line, the government line, about everybody being treated equally and all of that.
But, Mr. Clay, let's jump over Libya for now.
Okay.
And let's...
Yeah, that's because I was just getting into
exactly.
How I became. I don't want to, because the real issue is today is in fact, Mauritania and the Sudan.
And Mr. Muhammad, you deny that slavery is occurring in Mauritania despite this flurry of reports.
You have never read or heard me deny that at all. You
okay.
have never heard.
So you don't deny that.
No. You deny
wait
it in
a
Sudan.
Minute. Let me answer it. Let me answer it. I have never written, nor I have never denied. I said that I do not know of slavery existing in the Sudan. I cannot speak for Mauritania because I have never been there. But the Salim, it's a bigger issue than that. The bigger issue is, where did this issue start at? Who is Dr. Charles Jacobs? Who funds him? Who funded Samuel Cotton to travel over there?
I
funded,
can tell you that.
Let me finish my point. If you want to hear
okay.
from me, and then let me finish my point. If you don't want to hear from me, I can hang up the phone and y'all can
we want to hear
to discuss
from you.
It. But if you want an objective opinion, there is a root to this whole thing. And the root of it
objective
is...
Objective opinion.
Well, am I going to talk? Do you want me on the program or not, Salim?
Yes, sir. Yes,
okay,
sir, Mr. Muhammad.
Well, let me say something. There's a root to it. Dr. Charles Jacob with this American anti-slavery group. If you're going to talk about the issue of slavery, we were the last victims of the most horrible slavery known to humanity. How in the world can we justify or try to cover anybody enslaving black people? That's number one. But here's a Jewish man who is funding an operation. I want to know the relationship between the anti-American slavery group and Nate Clay's group. I want to know who's funding their conferences. Let me talk. If you let me talk and complete my trend of thought, and then I will listen to yours.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Who is funding these conferences that they're having? And if they're talking about the issue of slavery, there's a form of slavery going on in America. Why don't we deal with that? Where these southern
what
farmers
form of
are
slavery?
Picking up home. Am I going to talk? Maybe I should
go
just
ahead.
Hang up the phone, Salim.
go ahead. Go ahead.
If you want to attack, if there's an American anti-slavery group, and you want to attack the issue of slavery, there's a form of slavery going on in America right now. Why isn't that the issue that they're attacking, where these southern farmers are picking up homeless people, taking them to these places, working them, giving them alcohol and drugs, and actually have them in a form of slavery? CNN did a report on it on their international edition. I saw it in Cairo, Egypt.
I saw that, and that's a good question. But let
Mr. Clay
respond to your
There's
let
slavery
Mr.
going
respond
on in
to
Brazil.
Your questions.
The New York Times did a front page story on slavery
I'm well
in
aware
Brazil.
Of that. I'm well aware of that. And
but
there
the
are
issue
five
here,
different.
The issue
no,
the here
difference.
Is that this attack on the slavery in the Sudan, because when Numeri was the president of the Sudan and America was paying him to dump nuclear waste there and working with him to bring the Falassa Jews out of Ethiopia, there was never a question of slavery. When Sawahada was the head of state, there was never a question of slavery.
Yes, it
when
was.
When
Mr. Muhammad
El Mahdi was the head of state, there was never a question of slavery. Can I talk?
He's just rambling on.
Let
I'm
Mr. Clay
not rambling
respond
on.
To your
I'm bringing the facts to the surface.
Let
because
Mr. Clay respond
very divisive
to your specific
to the black
question.
Community,
well,
this whole
no, I don't see. I haven't heard one fact come from you yet. All I've
heard. Mr. Clay, why don't you respond to the questions about
all I've heard is empty accusations. Look, in the first place, my organization, the International Coalition Against Child Slavery, is the only organization for which I can speak. We are financed by myself and John Dunham. We have the forum we had cost us about $500. We paid for Sam Cotton's ticket to come in to speak. I took him around to community organizations, to churches, to schools, and we set up that community forum. it came, all of the expenditures, as I've told you, Celine, came from my pocket. I am a person. Wait,
what about Dr. Charles Jacobs? Do you know where his funding comes from?
Well, I don't know where he gets his money. I don't know what Charles Jacobs' organization. His organization is based in Massachusetts somewhere. My organization is based here. I know of Charles Jacobs because he called me after hearing me on National Public Radio about 5 years ago. He called me. I was talking about this issue long before what Akbar is talking about. In fact, I started out talking about slavery in Kuwait during the Gulf War because at that time, with the American soldiers being sent, and some black American soldiers heard me talking about it and refused their orders to the Gulf because they say they could not in good conscience go over there and fight and restore the emir to the throne, who then would continue to practice slavery. The London Supreme Court had documented that Kuwait was practicing slavery when the princess of Kuwait came to London and brought her entourage, and in the entourage, she had several slaves. Now, it's what of some people are jumping on this issue, and you don't know what all their motives may be. The Christian right is also speaking out on it. But the fact that people like Samuel Cotton and myself are speaking out on it and have been doing so for some time. I've been speaking out on this issue about 8 years.
You used to write a column for the Final Call, didn't you?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I've been speaking out on it by myself for 8 years. Now, Samuel Cotton, as far as his trip to Mauritania, where he spent 28 days underground investigating slavery and came back with irrefutable documentation. Wait a minute, I'm about to tell you. The Sunni black Muslims in New York City financed Cotton's trip. The black Sunni Muslims financed his trip, and their co-religionists in Mauritania hid him and directed him underground. That's who financed his trip.
Can I say this?
Yes, sir.
Salim, let me just say this, that when this issue first hit the fan with this Charles Jacobs, somebody financed him to send articles to every black newspaper in this country.
No,
slavery. Let me finish, Nate.
You got it all wrong,
Nate. Look, I have people. Nate, I know as many people in this country that own black newspapers.
Wait a minute. He just lied. That's not the way it happens at all. The NNPA, of which I am a member, I'm a newspaper.
Which is the National Newspaper Publishers Association.
The National Newspaper Publishers Association. We have a syndication operation. I send columns out. And they go to black newspapers all over the country. All I got to do is send it to the NNPA headquarters in Washington, D.C.
In fact, Akbar Muhammad, I've seen many of your columns syndicated by that.
That's all you got to do. So there's no sense in raising questions about.
Let's change the terminology. Let's say that they were sent to the National Newspaper Association by Dr. Charles Jacobs' operation to be placed in black newspapers. This is an old trick from the 60s when the FBI was doing the same thing. That's number one. Number two,
what are you talking about? It doesn't even work like that.
Nate,
it doesn't even work like that.
Are we going to debate this intelligently and listen to one another? Or are you going to get emotional like a child?
Mr. Muhammad, let me just come in here. This is Amy Goodman in New York. This is my question to Mr. Muhammad. You said that you don't deny that there's some slavery in the Sudan, and then you bring up the issue. And then
let's get my words carefully. I said that I do not know of slavery in the Sudan.
But then you bring up the issue of a man, Dr. Charles Jacobs, who is involved with exposing slavery in Sudan and Mauritania. Why does the fact that he's Jewish in some way invalidate what he has to say? And if there is slavery there, why not join with him in condemning slavery of black people?
Because the attack on slavery in the Sudan is an attack on the religion of Islam and the growing influence of Islam among young black people in this America, and Minister Farrakhan's influence in the Christian church and the respect that he has gained in the Christian church.
So
excuse me, Salim,
that's
I think
nonsense.
That I should end this conversation.
Muslims
the most
are
undignified
also
program that I've ever done.
Because Muslims are also
like
attacking.
Listen at him right now.
Akbar, you're just talking nonsense.
Muslims
are also attacking slavery in the Sudan.
What about those Muslims attacking?
Akbar, answer this question. What about the Muslims who are attacking?
If you want to listen to me, I'll debate it. I'll debate it anywhere in this country. because I happen to know the root of the whole problem.
But Mr. Muhammad, what about what Nate Clay just said about the black Sunni?
I cannot hear what he's saying. He's shouting like a child.
The one thing. Mr. Clay, if you could just stop for 1 second. The point that he made is Sam Cotton, who did his series in the black newspaper in New York, the City Sun, exposing slavery in the Sudan, that he got his funding from black Sunni Muslims in this area.
I have no knowledge of it. I have no knowledge of it.
But you say that he got his funding from other places. If you have no knowledge of it, why?
No, I have no knowledge of the Sunni Muslim community. I have knowledge that Dr. Charles Jacobs' group has been financing this whole operation, including Nate Clay.
That's the kind of nonsense.
And that
that's,
the very
you don't
fact
have any
that
knowledge.
This Jewish
Nate,
man.
Give me dates, time, and places. Give me names, Akbar.
Excuse me.
Nate, Mr. Humphrey.
Wait a minute. He said he has knowledge. I want him to present the proof. Ask him to present the proof.
Salim, maybe you can talk to Nate and let him close his mouth and use the intelligence that God blessed him with. Mr. Muhammad, times, places.
Give the evidence. Stop making empty accusations.
Mr. Clay, please let him complete a program of this caliber, arguing across the country with someone like Nate Clay. If we want to do a program of me alone, let me state my facts and let him answer. I think that's the best way to do it. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Thank you, Mr. Muhammad. Mr. Nate.
And that, in fact, is an example of the kind of acrimony that is provoked by this issue. And I suspect that that kind of acrimony will be repeated in other venues. If only this issue can be discussed in the kind of dispassionate. I think it's impossible for that to happen in this particular
case. Especially when someone comes on making a lot of empty accusations. He wants to accuse everybody who has spoken out on this issue as being somehow involved in some kind of international Zionist conspiracy, when in fact, on Savior's Day in Chicago, about four Sundays ago here in Chicago, Mr. Farrakhan himself said he disagreed with Akbar.
One of the points that I'd like to get to is, don't you think that your vociferous response to Akbar is in fact inflaming emotions on this issue, where it would be better to discuss it in a less inflamed situation?
Well, ideally, yes. But when someone sits there and rambles on, and then you all don't demand proof of him, I have to do it. You all just let him ramble and make accusations without demanding proof.
Mr. Clay, I asked Mr. Muhammad where he gets his information and put that question to him, that you said Sam Cotton received funding from black Sunni Muslims. He said he has no knowledge of it.
But I had to put it to him. You see, you all just let him make the accusations. I had to come with the information. And now if I had sat here quiet and not interjected, he'd have got away with that.
You have had your opportunity to respond to him.
Mr. Clay, we just have 1 minute, so I just want to let people know, if they want to get information, the kind of articles that you're putting out, more information on the Sudan and Mauritania, how can they do that?
Well, they can contact us at the International Coalition Against Chattel Slavery at 312-783-0287.
Give that number one more time.
312, that's the headquarters number, but seven in Chicago is 7 312 783 0287.
And there's a national number here, 202-637-3230.
That's Muhammad Afi's number in Washington, D.C., where we're based in D.C. also.
And since you now have the final word by default here, what do you want to leave our listeners with on the issue of slavery in the Sudan, and what can be done about it?
Well, there is no question that slavery exists, notwithstanding Akbar's attempts at obfuscation. Even his leader and mentor, Minister Farrakhan Muhammad, Minister Farrakhan said on Savior's Day that, quote, yes, maybe it does exist, but why are they bringing up this issue now, unquote. That's what Mr. Farrakhan himself said.
On that note, we're going to have to break, and I think you have made your point. Nathaniel Clay, chair of the International Coalition Against Chattel Slavery. We also want to thank Salim Wakil, co-host on Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Was produced by Julie Drizin with help from Pat Greenfield. It was engineered in New York by Matthew Finch with help from Paul Wunder. If you'd like a copy of today's show, 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay tuned tomorrow for another edition of Democracy Now!
Tune to Hi-Fi, WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial, New York.